This morning, we want to take up the topic of Hannah's prayer. And I'll be quite honest with you, I didn't know much about the prayer until I was asked about a year ago to do a study in Albertville, Alabama. That's just out from Huntsville, Alabama. In fact, they're meeting, the Huntsville class is meeting today, this weekend, on top of your convention date. So I put it together in a study form, and I'm trying to convert it into a discourse format, so I may have too much material, and I may stumble over, so I ask your forgiveness in advance. Okay, I've got a lot of reading to do today, so what we want to do is first read Hannah's prayer, and the prayer she uttered after Samuel was born. She uttered a prayer before he was born, and the prayer after she was born can be found in 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through 10. We want to understand more about her prayer. Hannah is the mother of the prophet and judge Samuel, and her prayer is, and I don't have my notes in front of me, but you can see she prays, and she says, "My heart rejoiceth in the Lord. Mine horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy as the Lord, for there is none beside thee. Neither is there any rock for our God, like our God. Talk no more so exceedingly proudly. Let not arrogancy come out of your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bowels of the mighty men are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. They that were full have hired out themselves for bread, and they that were hungry ceased, so that the barren hath borne seven, and she that hath many children is waxed feeble. The Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. The Lord maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and lifteth up. He raiseth up the poor out of the dust and lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill, to set them among princes and make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he hath set the world upon them. He will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness, for by strength shall no man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Out of heaven shall he thunder upon them. The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth, and he shall give strength unto his king, and exalt the horn of his anointed." Well, that's a pretty profound prayer, to say the least. And it indicates some knowledge of prophecy, some knowledge of the divine plan, if you will. But she utters this prayer, after Samuel was born. And how did she utter these prayers and with the presumed knowledge that we can accord to her? So in order to put it into perspective and context, let's read and review all of the first chapter of 1 Samuel and consider some of the history that obtains in the development of her prayer. So if we'll turn to 1 Samuel 1, chapter 1, verses 1 through 28, and we read, "There was a certain man of Ramathaim-Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jerohom, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children." "And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord were there. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons, and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. And her adversary had provoked her sore for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her, therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah to her husband to her, Hannah, why weepest thou? And why eatest thou not? Why is thy heart grieved? Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by the post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt look upon the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me, and forget not thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thy handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. And it came to pass, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. But Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I'm a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. And they rose up in the morning early and worshipped before the Lord and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son and called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of the Lord. And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto the Lord the yearly sacrifice in his vow. But Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord and there abide forever. And Elkanah, her husband, said unto her, Do what seemeth thee good. Tarry until thou have weaned him. Only the Lord establish his word. So the woman abode, gave her son suck until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with 3 bullocks, 1 ephah of flour, and a bottle of wine, and brought him unto the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. And they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here, praying unto the Lord, the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Now therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. So Hannah actually has 2 prayers in this particular account, the one before Samuel's born and one after. So let's try to get familiar with some of the characters and the sentiments of the times in which this drama unfolds. Samuel's birthplace is about 6 miles north of Jerusalem, and I guess, somewhere right in there, Ramah. And Bethel is Samuel's northern office, and Mizpah is Samuel's western office. Sounds like he has a field offices set up. In that place, he set up the Ebenezer stone on Mount Nebo in that region. And Gibeah, which is halfway between Ramah and Jerusalem, is the birthplace of Saul, who's the first king that Samuel anointed. And of course, Bethlehem, the birthplace of David and later Jesus, is pretty much centrally located in that area. Shiloh, which is where they went to worship, about 15 miles north of Ramah, is where Samuel was taken and he ministered as a child. So going back to our story in 1 Samuel 1, the time's about 11th century B.C., and we're immediately introduced to the genealogy of Samuel as it's recorded in 1 Chronicles 6, 33 through 38. An Ephrathite is also an Ephraimite, and an Ephrathite was a Levite. If we look at 1 Chronicles 6, 33 through 38, we read, "And these are they that waited with their children of the sons of the Kohathites, Heman, a singer, the son of Joel, the son of Samuel, the son of Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Eliel, the son of Toa, the son of Zuth, the son of Elkanah, the son of Mahath, the son of Amasai, the son of Elkanah, the son of Joel, the son of Azariah, the son of Zephaniah, the son of Tahath, the son of Asir, the son of Ebisaph, the son of Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, the son of Israel," or Jacob. According to the who's who in the Bible, Ephraim, of course we know in the Bible, was the second son of Joseph. And he received Jacob's blessing, although he was the younger. His descendants were to be more important than those of Manasseh, according to Jacob. In the blessing attributed to Moses, Joseph is promised great abundance and power, and it is added that the 10,000s of Ephraim in Deuteronomy 33:17. In the conquest of Canaan under Joshua, the tribe of Ephraim was allocated to the central hill south of Shechem and extended into the coastal plain. You know, in this time, there was a deep religious sentiment among the Jews. This was not long after Samson and Ruth, and they were still of some pure nature before they had descended into idolatry. And so the people were prone to worship as they were told. By divine direction, they went annually up to worship the Lord to offer sacrifice at the feast time, the Passover. Samuel is styled the first of the prophets of Israel. Reprints 56:16 says that the prophet Samuel established a new order of things. He did not do as others had before him had done. He had have his place of residence to which all the people would go to and ask his advice. But he introduced the circuit judge system. So he went around to the countryside and counseled with those who were interested. We are back on our story. In verse 2, we read that Elkanah had two wives. Multiple marriages were allowed at this time. And as you can see, there was strife among Peninnah and Hannah because of the one being full of children, the other not. We read later that Hannah had five more children after Samuel, but she never really forgot her firstborn. We read that in 1 Samuel 2, verses 18 through 20. Eli was a descendant of Aaron's son Ithamar, and he was high priest at the sanctuary at Shiloh in the period of the judges. Eli's, we're told, had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who were priests of the Lord. The tabernacle status, following the Joshua, the discussion of Joshua with the children of Manasseh regarding the occupation and settling of the land, Joshua establishes the ark in Shiloh. That can be found in Joshua 18:1. It says that, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together in Shiloh, and Joshua set up the tabernacle of the congregation there, and the land was subdued before them. Prior to that, the ark was established in Gilgal, but Shiloh was considered a strategic site in the hill country, which could be defended better, and it was more centrally located for all the tribes. This holy tent was of importance to the Israelites because this is where they met God. Exodus 29, verses 42 through 46 establishes the order of worship, and I won't get into reading it now, but God required there to be a continual burnt offering in accordance with his details. And the purpose was that he might always dwell with them. And the message was always the same. God wanted to dwell with his people, regardless of whether they wanted to do so themselves. Now, these two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, you probably know they weren't really good guys. They were, as we read in, as you can read further into 1 Samuel 2, verse 12, now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, for they knew not the Lord. These two sons were noted for their brutality and their lust. They abused the office of the priesthood by seducing women who came to the temple and by taking the best parts of the sacrificial meat. Eli remonstrated them, but they didn't really take to that kind of advice. Later, Eli is admonished about that. Their sinfulness provoked a curse against their father's house, and they were judged by the Lord when they took the ark into battle with the Philistines, and there they were both killed. His son's death were also prophesied in 1 Samuel 2:27 by a, quote, man of God, end quote, who also appeared in the house of his fathers while they were in Egypt. Who was that man of God? We might suggest it was the Logos or one of the angels. Additionally, family longevity was not to occur in Eli's progeny because we read in 1 Samuel 31 verses 31 through 33, behold, the days come that I will cut off thine arm and arm of thy father's house, that there shall not be an old man in thine house, and thou shalt see an enemy in my habitation, in all the wealth which God shall give Israel, and there shall not be an old man in thine house forever, and the man of thine whom I shall not cut off from mine altar shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thine heart, and all the increase of thine house shall die in the flower of their age. So that was, I guess that's what they say in the South, were their comeuppance for their lifestyle. Well, this giving of gifts to of Elkanah to his wives and giving more to Hannah. These portions that we read about were generally food or peace offerings. This was an Eastern custom, and they were given to the recipient to show regard for the beloved or distinguished guests. You know, Joseph did the same with Benjamin, with the meal packed in their bags after, in Egypt. But to Hannah he gave a worthy portion because he loved her, and probably because of her barren condition. The adversary that we read about in verse number 6, we can guess it was Peninnah. She was she was taunting Hannah, and you know, domestic disturbances like these occur often in polygamous families, and so I suspect that was what occurred there. The barren condition, you know, was there a stigma attached to it then? Yes, there was. In Job 24, verses 21 and 22, we read, "The evil man," this is out of the Amplified Version, "preys upon the barren, childless woman and does no good to the widow. Yet God prolongs the life of the wicked," or the mighty, "by his power. They rise up, and when they had despaired of life," and in verse 7, we're told that he goes up year by year. This is by the commandment. And each time Hannah is, she's down in the dumps. She doesn't have a baby. She doesn't have the one she desires. And Elkanah says, there, why are you weeping? You know, am I not good enough for you? I mean, it's this typical male ego or what? Or just a failure to have a good insight into how the woman feels. Elkanah must have thought a lot of himself, must have had a high self-esteem, but needless to say, that was not the right thing to say at the time. So the verse 9 says, Hannah rose up after they'd eaten in Shiloh and after they drank, and she begins her prayer. Her prayer is heard by Eli, and she's mumbling her prayer, and actually there's no audible sound to it. She's moving her lips, and he thinks she's drunk, and gives her a hard time about it. And the verse 10 says she was in bitterness of soul. You know, she prays to the Lord, and she weeps sore. And you know, have we ever experienced bitterness of soul? Do those words even do justice to how she might have felt? But she vows a vow in her prayer. She says that if the Lord will give her a child, she will dedicate that child to him. And she actually registers the Nazarite vow for Samuel. And that is unusual because, you know, the case of Samson, he took the vow himself. But in this particular case, Hannah registers the vow. Won't go into all the details of the Nazarite vow because our time is going to run short on us. We want to get to the heart of Hannah's prayer. There is a lesson, though, in that particular action of Hannah for us as Bible students. I mean, you know, if those of us who are parents and had children, what should we do? Of course, we should dedicate our children to the Lord. We should offer them up to Him before they can make that choice for themselves. At least we place them in His care and keeping. And the Scripture tells us, you know, train up a child in the way they should go, and they will remember that. Well, so our mandate as parents is to always encourage youth to make a stand for the Lord. And also explain the seriousness of a vow to the Lord, because Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 5 says, "When you vow a vow to God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which has vowed. Better is it that thou shouldst not vow, that thou shouldst vow and not pay." So Eli, thinking she was drunk in her prayer, you know, for one thing, he didn't have the facts. It's a false accusation. And it was probably based on his experience with his own sons. So, you know, did Hannah have any wine in her possession? He probably didn't see any wine urns or bottles surrounding, so he just jumps to conclusion But evidently, drinking alcoholic beverages in those days was a commonplace thing for relief of stress and anxiety, much like it is today. But she rebuffs him and says, no, I'm a woman of a sorrowful spirit, and she's not drinking wine or strong drink, and sets him straight, which he needs. Eli immediately does an about face and gives her assurance that the Lord will remember her, and the Lord does remember her. With the miraculous interposition of divine power, he quickened her, quickened the dormant and inoperative natural forces, just in the case of Sarah. And we read that in verse 20, when it came to pass the time was come, Hannah had conceived and she bore a son and named him Samuel because she had asked him of the Lord. We read in this account that Elkanah and all his house go up once again to offer to the Lord yearly sacrifice and his vow, as we read in 21. His vow? That wasn't his vow, it was Hannah's vow. But according to Jewish law, the husband had to confirm the vow that the wife made in order for it to be valid. So this is what happens. He confirms it, and all is done according to the law. How much more time do we have?
About 10 minutes.
Well, 10 minutes is not as much time as I wanted to go, but what I want to do is move on to her prayer. So that would be to... Hannah's prayer. In her prayer, this seems to be an inspired and prophetic prayer, and it indicates knowledge that heretofore had not been understood by the Lord's people of the Old Testament. She says her horn is exalted in the Lord. This horn is an allusion to the dress of Eastern women. You know, they wore a horn on their head, and if it was oblique, they did not have any children. And if the horn was perpendicular or in line with the head, it indicated that she did have children. In verse 15, David comments on the power and privilege of Hannah's prayer in saying in Psalm 5:3, my voice shalt thou hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning will I direct my prayer unto thee and will look up. David, speaking and singing to God for his victories in 2 Samuel 22:37 through 38, says, thou hast enlarged my steps under me so that my feet did not slip. I have pursued mine enemies and destroyed them and turned not again until I had consumed them. The very familiar psalm of David in 27:1, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Hannah says there's none as holy as the Lord, and there's none beside him. Moses and the children of Israel, in singing to the Lord in Exodus 15:1, say, who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? And Moses telling the Pharaoh on the occasion of the frog plagues that there's none like God. In Exodus 8:10, he says, tomorrow, and he said, And he said, be it according to thy word, that thou mayest know that there is none like unto the Lord our God. David speaking indicates that God is a rock in 2 Samuel 22:47. The Lord liveth, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of the rock of my salvation. In verse 3, Hannah says, talk no more exceedingly proudly. Let not arrogancy come out of your mouth. Speaking of arrogance, David says in Psalm 12:4, who have said with our tongue, will we prevail? Our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us? In Psalm 69:5, God's knowledge is indicated by, O God, thou knowest my foolishness, and my sins are not hid from thee, as if David is vindicating his innocence. God is a searcher. David, talking to Solomon, says in 1 Chronicles 28:9, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a perfect heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee. But if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever. Hannah says, the bowels of the mighty men are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. David, in speaking of the wicked, says, the sword pierces their own heart. In Psalm 37:15, their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bowels shall be broken. Jehovah and the Logos, in dealing with the builders of the Tower of Babel, say in Genesis 11:8, so the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build the city. David tells us that there's strength and weakness in Psalm 8:2. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. Hannah goes on by saying, they that were full have hired themselves out for bread, and they that were hungry ceased, so that the barren hath borne seven, and she that hath many children has waxed feeble. She has a little bit of knowledge about that subject. With regard to worldly fullness, Moses, commenting on Israel's good fortune in Deuteronomy 32:15, says, but Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxen fat, thou art grown thick, thou art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God, which made him, and lightly. In Psalm 113:9, we read, he maketh the barren woman to keep house, and to be a joyful mother of children. Praise ye the Lord. In a reference to spiritual Zion, our mother, or the covenant under which we are, we read in Isaiah 54:1, sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing and cry aloud, that thou didst not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. The Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down the grave and bringeth up. That's a strong, strong language. Job tells us the same thing in Job 5:18. He binds up the wounds, his hands make whole. Hosea tells us, come, let us return unto the Lord, for he has torn and he will heal us, and he has smitten us, and he will bind us up. This reminds us of God's promise of beauty for ashes, oil for joy, for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. In Genesis 2:7, God is said to make alive in the beginning. As a very familiar scripture, we know this is where life began. And Job in 27:3, exclaims that the Spirit of God was in his nostrils. God's power is indicated by David speaking to the congregation about his son Solomon in 1 Chronicles 29:12. The Lord makes poor and he makes rich. He brings low, brings down low, bringeth the low and lifteth up. With regards to abasement, and God admonishes Job out of the whirlwind in Job 40:12, and says to look on everyone that is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked in their places. God reminds Moses of who sustained him in Deuteronomy 8:18. I just heard this said on TV. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers as it is this day. Hannah continues in this dissertation about the divine plan. She says he raises up the poor out of the dust and lifts up the beggar from the dunghill. With regard to poor, Elihu preaches to his friend Job in 36:6 by saying, He preserveth not the life of the wicked, but gives right to the poor. And Job, again, in proclaiming God's faithfulness in 29:12, says, because I delivered the poor that cried, and the fatherless, and him that had none to help him. David also cites the faithfulness of God in the familiar Psalm 37:25. I'm young, now I'm old. I've been young, now I'm old. And yet I've not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. Saints are exalted. In a very familiar psalm which was quoted earlier, Psalm 91, God speaks to Moses in Exodus 19:4 and reminds him of the divine support that he gave them in Egypt. He says, you've seen what I've done to the Egyptians and how I've bear you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Hannah speaks of the Lord's pillars in the reading Genesis 1:1. Getting near the end of her prayer, she says he will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness, for by strength shall no man prevail. Is this a reference to the coming dark night? You know, our Father is a divine keeper, as we read in Genesis 28:15. And the feet of the saints are spoken of in 2 Samuel 22:34, where we read, he maketh my feet like hinds' feet and setteth me upon high places. We are assured of our place of defense in Isaiah 33:16, when we read, he shall dwell on high, his place of defense shall be the munition of rocks, bread shall be given him, his waters shall be sure. And men silenced in Job 5:16, when we read, the poor hath hope and iniquity stoppeth her mouth. Especially at the last day, iniquity will be done away with. Those are my postscripts. Job speaks of this coming darkness in connection with the wicked. He says, the light of the wicked shall be put out. This is what we're looking for, brethren, in the kingdom. And the spark of his fire shall not shine. Light and darkness are contrasted in Proverbs 13:9, when we read, the light of the righteous rejoiceth, but the lamp of the wicked shall be put out. We have a warning issue to us in Proverbs. In Proverbs 24:20, that there will be no reward to the evil man, and the candle of the wicked will be put out. And finally, the last verse of her prayer. I'm sure her prayer wasn't issued in verses, but we did it that way. She speaks of the Lord's adversaries, and it seems to be speaking of the closing of this age and the age to come. When we read, the adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces, and out of heaven shall he thunder upon them. God's enemies are described in Moses singing to Jehovah after some 400 years of slavery in Exodus 15:6, when he says, "Thy right hand, O Lord, has become glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, has dashed in pieces the enemy." Incidentally, when Hannah says the anointed at the end of her prayer, where she says, "Exalt the horn of his anointed," this is the first place in the Bible where anointed is used in context of a savior or a redeemer, a Messiah. And because as yet there was no king. Samuel was just a little bitty boy, maybe 12 years old. So there was no king yet. So that indicated prophetic knowledge. Solomon describes the fall of the wicked in Proverbs 11:5. "The righteousness of the perfect shall direct his way, but the wicked shall fall by his own wickedness." After receiving commission from God, Moses went into Pharaoh's court and stretched forth his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire ran along upon the ground, and the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt. God is a judge in Genesis 18:25, where Abraham and God are talking about Sodom's destruction, and actually calls God's judgment into question when he says, "That be far from thee to do after this matter, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so and that the righteous should be as the wicked. That be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" Can you imagine talking to God this way? And of course we know how it went in Sodom's destruction. Went from 50 to 40 to 30 to 20 and down. It just counted down. And we know how it turned out. David sings the same in Psalm 18:1, where strength is promised. He says, "For thou hast girded me with strength to battle. Them that rose up against me hast thou subdued unto me." And the final thought in the prayer is that the saints will be exalted. And of course, we've read this in Psalm 91:14, "Because he has set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name." So Hannah closes her prayer with the same sentiment that she opens up with. And she shows to us as New Testament saints that she had some understanding of God had dealt with her in a special way. And just for further consideration, you might look at the prayer that Mary, the mother of Jesus, uttered, what's known in the musical circles as the Magnificat, about what she experienced upon learning about the Lord, the child she was going to bear. And after, it's just a remarkable similarity of the two prayers. And I'll just close with that and ask the Lord's blessing.